I'm pregnant. And this entire lengthy narrative in 2 Samuel, I'm not, by the way, but I mean, in this entire lengthy narrative here in 2 Samuel, these are the only words we hear Bathsheba say. We hear all about King David. We heard about his lust as he looks down on Bathsheba from his palace that stands high above the other roofs in the city. We've watched him inquire about who she is, learn that she is Uriah's wife, and he sends for her. He takes her anyway. And we can't turn our eyes from the fact that David rapes Bathsheba. Womanist scholar Will Gaffney writes that rabbinic and Christian fathers, as well as contemporary interlocutors, describe this event as adultery, signifying consent on Bathsheba's part. But Gaffney argues that isn't what we see here. Rape is an abuse of power that can include relational and positional power in addition to physical power. The power dynamic here is clear. David uses the power and authority of his office to wield lethal violence to keep her. He sees her, sends for her, has sex with her without her consent. He rapes her. Perhaps David thinks nothing more of it. The story doesn't tell us if he's done this before or if he'll do it again. It doesn't tell us if Bathsheba went home and tried to wash herself clean of this violation. It doesn't tell us what this trauma felt like to the one who was taken. Instead, the story skips straight to the part where Bathsheba sends this message back to King David: I'm pregnant. David then sets out on a destructive path to cover up the truth. He sends for Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, from the battlefield. He thinks if Uriah will just have sex with his wife, this mess will all be over. David does all that he knows to get Uriah to lay with Bathsheba. He uses ancient Near Eastern sexual innuendos like, "Go down to your house and wash your feet," though Uriah refuses to do so. Uriah has just come from the front lines of war. He doesn't know how to simply set that trauma aside and make love to his wife. Of course, we know how the story goes. Next, David tries to get Uriah drunk, thinking surely he'll go have sex with his wife when he's drunk. And when that doesn't work, David keeps on trying to cover up the evil he's already done, and things go from bad to worse. David sends word with Uriah himself to place him on the front lines of the battlefield so that he'll be killed. Sure enough, that's what happens. Uriah is killed, and the news is delivered back to David. And when David hears the news, he has the audacity to encourage the troops and tell them not to be upset about those who have died by the sword, to go on attacking. But let's not lose track of Bathsheba. We're talking about her story today, after all. Not only has David raped her and impregnated her, but now he's made her a widow. To understand the weight of this, we have to look at widows in an ancient Near Eastern culture. They're highly vulnerable. Like all women of that time, they're considered property. Only widows are particularly at risk because they're no longer the property of their father, nor their husband, because he's dead. They have no family and no land, and therefore no protection. If we're paying attention to the Torah, the law, especially as stated in Deuteronomy, we find that over and over the people of Israel, those who have covenanted with God, are commanded to look out for, to care for, to provide for the widows and the orphans. Or to add words that we might hear ringing true, especially in our ears today, the immigrant, the poor, the dispossessed. Bathsheba is the victim of rape. Her husband has been murdered, and she's widowed all at David's hand. And at the end of today's text in Samuel, we hear that she mourned for her husband, and after her mourning was over, David sent for her and made her his wife. I wish I could say that this story couldn't get any worse, but it did. The prophet Nathan confronts David about the evil that he has done by telling him a parable. David realizes it, but his punishment is the death of the child that's growing in Bathsheba's womb. So after all of this, Bathsheba becomes a parent who's lost a child. Using her womanist imagination, Will Gaffney hears Bathsheba confronting David and demanding the respect she's due. "You're not going to shut me away as you did your first wife, Michael. You stole the life that I had with my husband in the sight of God, the man I love, the husband I chose to live with. You stole our future and you stole our children. I can't get that back, but I can have your children and the security that comes with them. I will be the mother of kings." Indeed, she will, but we're not there yet. You might be asking yourself, now, why are we looking at this story today? Why would we look at such a traumatic, grief-ridden story just 3 days before we celebrate Jesus' birth? Maybe you've been here every Sunday during Advent, and you're totally aware that we're looking at the 5 women that are named in Jesus' lineage in Matthew's gospel, the women we're calling mothers of the movement: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, the wife of Uriah, yes, that's Bathsheba, and last but certainly not least, Mary. Even still, even for me, this all feels a bit jarring. But before I run away or turn my head, I want to hang on, to bend my ear, to keep looking, even if it feels hard, because all 5 of these women are named in Jesus' lineage. If we look at them together, we realize that at least 3 of the 5 are widows. Tamar was widowed twice. Rahab might have been a widow. That could have been the very real reason she had to hustle to make a living. Ruth was a widow, as was her mother-in-law, Naomi. Bathsheba became a widow at the hands of the king. And if we want to peer ahead, we know that Mary will become a widow too, but we'll save her story for Christmas Eve and the days that follow. These women all know profound loss, and they all know profound vulnerability too. But they don't ask for our pity or sympathy. Rather, they seek survival and justice. They demand our attention, our solidarity, our respect. They are subjects, they are actors, they are creators, they are ones who can sing a broken hallelujah. Jesus is born into a lineage that isn't neat or sanitized. The ones who would be cast aside in an ancient Near Eastern world are the ones who are written into the narrative of Jesus' birth. In a patriarchal world, their names are etched into the sacred text for centuries to come. And if we linger here long enough to pay attention to where Jesus is born, to poor immigrant parents who flee oppression in fear for their lives, we might be able to imagine where Jesus is being born this season, these days, among us. Today's story in 2 Samuel isn't actually the end of Bathsheba's story. She enters the scene again in 1 Kings when David is nearing the end of his life. She's had at least 4 male children with David, the youngest of whom is Solomon. Unfortunately, the story doesn't actually tell us if she had any female children, though the odds are that she did. Adonijah, one of David's sons, is plotting to take over his father's kingdom as David is dying and has proclaimed himself king. He's vying for the throne because David hasn't named a crown prince. Because of this, Bathsheba's life and family is threatened once again. An insecure monarch would likely kill off his siblings and any perceived rivals. So we find Bathsheba and the prophet Nathan plotting together to save their lives and have Solomon named king instead. They decide that Bathsheba will go to David and take her own life and fate and that of her son Solomon's into her own hands. She says to David, "Did my master, not the king, swear to your servant, your son Solomon will certainly rule after me. He will sit on my throne." Nathan the prophet comes in and backs her up, and sure enough, David declared to Bathsheba that her son will succeed him and sit on the throne. She has made a way out of no way once again. If we're still wondering why we journey with Bathsheba to the manger today, a story filled with trauma, loss, grief, vulnerability, resilience, and more, maybe we can pause and reflect on our own stories. What do we carry with us this season as we move towards Christmas? In this most wonderful time of the year, some of us carry grief and profound sadness. Maybe we've been widowed from our families by physical death or the death of relationships. Maybe we've been traumatized or love people who have. Pastor Maria reflected this past week in her latest happenings column about all that we have carried together this year. Those of you who have lost loved ones, those of you who have been caretaking family members, those of you who are holding intense vocational questions, those of you working on front lines and fronteras of all kinds, those of you seeking wholeness in family systems that have left little room for your wholeness, those of you aging, those of you working harder than a just world would expect anyone to work, those of you making ends meet and seeing those ends fray at the same time, those of you too far from people you love, those of you falling in love, those of you falling out of love, those of you becoming your deepest selves, those of you asking such painful and beautiful questions of interrogation about your faith and identity. We journey with Bathsheba. We journey with these mothers of the movement because we know their struggles. We know their heartaches. We know their hopes and dreams and cries for justice too. We journey with these women to see where Jesus is born. May we have open eyes. and open hearts as love is born in our midst, as a baby, like a child. Emmanuel, God with us.